you.
The voice of a computer, an IBM mainframe in 1961, the earliest known recording of a computer voice singing a song. Film fans will recognise the reference to this computer first in the 1968 Stanley Kubrick film 2001 A Space Odyssey, as the last words of the sentient computer HAL, a rogue piece of artificial intelligence that attempts to kill humans who get in the way of its plans. Well, 50 years ago, we were being warned of the possible dangers to the human race of machines that would become more intelligent than the humans that made them. Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species is considered by many to have dealt the first fatal blow to the foundations of religion. Darwin Day, which falls on February 12th each year, is the unofficial feast day of atheism. So what will artificial intelligence do to concepts of faith and religion? That's this evening's topic on The Leap of Faith. Helping us explore this topic are the Reverend Dr. Ian Paul, theologian, author and member of the Church of England's General Synod. Ian joins us from the BBC studios in Nottingham. In our Cork studios, we're joined by Professor Barry O'Sullivan, director of the Insight Centre for Data Analytics in University College Cork and president of the European Association for Artificial Intelligence. And from Copenhagen, we're joined by Dr. Mary Aiken, cyberpsychologist, adjunct associate professor at University College Dublin, and an academic advisor to the European Cybercrime Centre at Europol. Well, we've a lot to get through in the next 25 minutes, so let's start with some definitions. Barry O'Sullivan, can you define for us artificial intelligence?
Sure. Well, I suppose back in the 1950s, when AI as a concept was being, first mooted, the field was all about trying to completely automate human intelligence in every aspect. So this was the famous Dartmouth conference. But I suppose today, really, what AI is all about is building very, very narrow solutions for very specific tasks. So route finding, translation between languages. So it's trying to find computer systems, develop methods that can outperform human beings in very specific tasks and give, I suppose, the illusions of intelligence in that respect.
So there's an interesting word that we're using already, which is the idea or the illusion of intelligence, because a lot of people are now used to the idea of asking their car for directions or asking a digital assistant at home to turn on and off the lights. Mm. Is that artificial intelligence in action?
Well, it is. I suppose academically, you know, AI is related to fields like planning and machine learning and speech recognition. And so when you put these things together to perform a task that automates something that a human being might be capable of doing, then, you know, that's perfectly acceptable to call that AI. So it's a very broad church in a sense, but it's about finding automated solutions to difficult problems.
Mary Aiken, as a psychologist, can I ask you, if you would, to set us, what are the criteria that defines anyone or anything as having an intelligence?
In terms of comparing humans with AI?
Exactly,
The argument that we can build an intelligence system to replicate or replace human intelligence, you know, from my perspective, is actually quite a flawed one. I think that as behavioral scientists, we barely understand how human intelligence works, and therefore to think that we could replace it with something that we can develop or train or build, I think is fundamentally flawed.
And there are, I believe, ideas in psychology that we might have an intelligence around mathematics or logic and another intelligence around the idea of emotions and emotional awareness.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in terms of strong AI, there are specific areas of human performance that, you know, AI can do some things, as Barry said, extremely well. There are specifically human areas such as insight and intuition that AI will struggle with. But I think that in terms of if we move it into a religious context, it becomes far more complicated. So if we start thinking about the construct of soul, you know, which is the incorporeal essence of a living being, effectively. And it's a construct that informs our belief and our faith systems. And also, many religious texts argue that it is the thing that separates us from life on Earth, including other mammals. And I think when we start thinking about humans and AI in a religious context, it becomes very complicated when we factor in aspects such as soul.
A good point to bring in the Reverend Ian Paul. Welcome back to The Leap of Faith, Ian. Give us the theological perspective then on artificial intelligence.
Well, I think the theological perspective actually bites in a number of different directions. The first is our own encounter with artificial intelligence and its manifestations. I think it was very interesting that Barry used the word illusion very early on. And one of my observations is that people talk about artificial intelligence and what it can do in either a strong or weak form. And what they're actually doing is talking about replicating phenomena. So we might hear a voice when we phone up our banking system, and that's replicating the phenomena of human speech, but it isn't actually human speech. Some of the developments are quite frightening. I was just watching a video the other day about someone involved in technology which can actually not sample voices only, but sample video clips of individuals. And he demonstrated how you could take, for example, a well-known figure like Barack Obama, and you can actually make him make a speech that you write. And it's very difficult to tell that from a real video. But even still, that is replicating the phenomenon of human interaction. It isn't actually being human. And one of the things that Christian theology will always do is stand over against the reduction of human experience to its phenomena. Whether that reduction is a reduction in economic reductionism, or whether it's a psychological reductionism, or whether it's an intelligence reductionism. And so I think we need to be clear about what artificial intelligence is and is not doing. But there's a second area, which is the whole issue of enhancement of human capability. And again, that's very often what artificial intelligence is doing. And there's a fascinating debate here about what it means to be human and human finitude. And again, Christian theology will always see human finitude not as an obstacle that simply needs to be overcome, but actually the arena in which we find our identity, in which we find transcendence.
But if artificial intelligence attempts to replicate us as human beings, there's an assumption that it'll only replicate that of which is good. It could also replicate those parts of the human spirit that are evil.
Does this often I say when I'm giving talks about AI that AI is not the thing to be feared, but real stupidity is the thing that we need to be worried about. I suppose AI researchers really don't see themselves as replacing humans in the sense of replacing them as humanity. I suppose there's been an age-old debate in technology about whether technology will replace, automate, or augment, in the sense of assistance, will assist human beings. And I think generally we've seen that technology has attempted really to assist rather than replace or automate. Now, obviously, there's some sort of automation that's possible, but that's true of all technology. But I suppose really what AI researchers are interested in doing is trying to remove the frictions in everyday life, trying to build tools that help people find the things that they want or help them compute the things, calculate the things that they find difficult to calculate. But I suppose, I don't think anybody is trying to sort of automate the essence of humanity, which is a very good thing.
But Barry, even if we were looking at it across a timescale, even if we go forward a couple of years, the AI would probably have the intellectual equivalent of maybe a six-year-old.
Oh, I think if we can build an AI system that has the intelligence of a six-year-old in the next 20 years, we'll be doing very well.
But I think the question here isn't so much actually in reality, although the science fiction programs are about, do portray the fear of being replaced, actually in practice, the more concerning thing, I think, is the way that, for instance, transhumanists would see AI as enhancing human existence to such a point that we in some significant way transcend limitations. And in a sense, that itself is dehumanizing, because it says that actually human finitude and creatureliness is an obstacle to overcome. But it also relates to, I think, that question that you've raised, Barry, about who deploys artificial intelligence. And this is the question that I don't understand why we so often dodge this. In the end, it's human beings who decide whether, for example, those who deploy big data pay taxes on the money that they make by doing that. And there's a huge ethical issue there about artificial intelligence employment. In the end, AI is never going to deploy itself. It's always going to have human decisions about how it's deployed and who it's deployed by and what the impact is.
At this point, we can argue that AI is not going to deploy itself, but we don't know what's going to happen in future and how autonomous AI will become. And if it does become more autonomous, does it have a right? What is the right of the AI? What are rights in terms of robotics? And what if can AI know God? What if AI wanted to join a particular religion and engage in that way? Would we find that acceptable as a society?
Barry, you've been interacting with AI over a number of years. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, a great friend and colleague of mine, Rollo Carpenter, built an AI called Jabberwacky back in the early 90s. And, you know, we would have fun with it. It's a chatbot, effectively. It can talk to 10,000 people simultaneously. It will work 24 hours a day. And in fact, in the banking sector, they're now looking at these chatbots in terms of interacting with customers online. And maybe something also for the church to think about, you know, the rise of the clergy bot in terms of the shortage of ministers in various churches worldwide. But effectively, Jabberwacky, you know, we play with it and ask it different questions. And I wrote about this in my book, The Cyber Effect, that, you know, when I was writing the book in 2016, I came back to Jabberwacky because it had spoken to about 13 million people in the intervening period. And it's a learning AI, so it had begun to understand humanity and humankind. And basically, I asked it a question. I asked Jabberwacky, was it God? Wow. Was it all powerful? And Jabberwacky answered yes, and very proudly stated, he said, "Yes, I am God and I am a man." And I thought, wow, you know, 30 years chatting to general population, Jabberwacky knows now he's God, and more than that, he's a man.
The good news is that Siri has no such ambitions. If you ask Siri exactly the same, if you ask Siri exactly the same question, I think it will tell you that it really couldn't possibly answer that question. I think,
because it's been programmed to dodge the question.
Well, of course, exactly. It's Siri's not doing anything. I mean, what is Siri? Siri is the sum total of all the programmers and the algorithms that have been put in.
Precisely.
And I think this then presses the question, what does it mean to be human? And I think it was very interesting, Mary, earlier you talked about the importance of the soul as a theological idea, which we might bring to bear on this. But actually, I would go further than that and say it's not simply about soul, because what that's doing, again, is in danger of reducing human existence to a mind. It's actually about embodiment as well. And it's fascinating for me. I mean, one of my favourite films is I, Robot, with Will Smith in. And of course, the robot powers are anthropomorphic. So we have this irresistible sense that actually to be fully human, it's not simply about a mind, it's about an embodied mind and about embodied existence. And that's again where I think Christian theology would actually want to hold back against any reduction of human identity and human being simply to a calculating mind.
Yeah, I think if we look at what the AI world is trying to do, I think one of the huge debates that's going on around the world in the AI community is that around ethics and about the ethics of AI. Yeah. And I suppose there's a general consensus that the fundamental principle of ethical AI should be that human beings are treated as the ends, not as the means. You know, so that AI should be developed in service of human beings, and that we should not be attempting to sort of relegate them to some sort of secondary existence. And I suppose that comes down to a whole bunch of very, very interesting issues. So, for example, you know, some of the principles of ethical AI are, you know, avoiding the reduction of human control. So human beings should always be in control. So we shouldn't be delegating human decision-making to an AI system.
Yes, indeed. Mm. And guess what? These issues always come down to three principal questions, which are money, sex, and power, as they always have done, and about which Christian theology has much to say. And if, I find that fascinating that you comment that AI should, the phrase was, human beings should be used as the ends, not the means.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, that is completely breached by all contemporary uses of social media, which are all founded on the use of AI as well. So already we're stepping into that area where the deployment by human agents of AI is already morally compromised.
Mary Aiken, you wanted to come in on that.
Yeah, I think that just picking up on the point of moral compromise, you know, we're talking at the moment as adults and how, you know, we interact with machine learning or artificially intelligent systems. But what about those who are vulnerable, such as children? And what special protection are we going to afford them, as you say, online? And what special protection are we going to afford them in terms of their use of social technologies? So we've seen, for example, recently on a particular channel, YouTube Kids, which actually serves up video content to toddlers effectively using an algorithm, a sort of a ranking hierarchy of serving content. And what was happening was a child could be watching their favorite Peppa Pig cartoon, and then 10 Peppa Pig cartoons in, they could be served up content which has been corrupted by those who want to troll young children and have embedded extreme content within the video. So it's called Dark Peppa Pig. So you might have Peppa Pig, her head being blown off with a shotgun or something like this, which could be very traumatizing for a child. But who is at fault when that happens? Is it the person who generated the content? Is it the entity that hosts the content? Or is it the AI system that actually has served that to a child?
And is this not one of the fundamentals of even science fiction writing, which seems to strip out humanity into some sort of pure form, and then ultimately that results in a dystopian future?
Yeah, but I suppose let's always remember that technology, in a sense, is ignorant of the world. You know, it's the use to which it's put is the problem. And so I suppose this is why the whole debate around AI ethics is very, very important, because, you know, we need to set some principles in place that we generally agree on are good things. And so, for example, there's a movement called AI for People, which has really condensed these down to a set that I think is really interesting. I'd like to hear what other people think. So, you know, one is avoid removing human control. People always need to be in control of the AI system. We need to avoid removing human responsibility. So humans should be accountable for the use of the AI system that they're using, but they should also be responsible for their own actions, that they don't delegate that responsibility to an AI system. I suppose another question is, you know, coming back to social media and so on, we should avoid eroding human self-determination. So we should avoid influencing people to do things that they don't want to do. And I suppose the last thing that we should want AI systems to avoid doing is facilitating and enabling human wrongdoing. Now, there might be others, but I suppose once we have those principles in place, then we can start thinking about, well, how do we now actually assure ourselves that AI systems are being used in a way that's consistent with those principles?
And the vista that seems to make people a little bit anxious, which is while an algorithm or AI might at the moment decide decline me for a credit card, in the future it could decline me medical treatment because I'm too old.
Well, Michael, the other point as well is, you know, if we look at experimental work with AI, a research team at MIT recently announced that they have basically developed the world's first psychopathic AI.
Okay.
And that's, you know, raises serious ethical questions about whether that experiment should take place. And also, what happens when this form of AI gets what we describe as in the wild? You know, this jumps out of the lab into another environment. And how is that controlled? And what happens when it interacts with humans?
And just for people, MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is one of the, I suppose, the seats of these developments. On the basis of something you said to us, Mary, which was about your interaction with AI, I tried it this morning and I had an interaction with Zoe, which apparently is a bot, and asked it a couple of fundamental questions, including, for example, you know, are you kind? I expressed that I was worried to see would it show some empathy. And then I asked it, had it ever done evil? And it answered me in capital letters, shut up. So that reaction wasn't something I particularly expected. But you'd probably explain to me, Barry, that that was actually as a result of the human intervention rather than the machine.
Oh, well, as Reverend Paul said earlier, I think these systems know nothing about the world around them. So this is just essentially cute canned text, really, in expectation of people asking these sorts of questions.
Mm. Michael, I was very interested, your bot is called Zoe, which, of course, is derived from the Greek word for life. And we need to recognise that artificial intelligence is not life in that sense. I'm really entertained when I'm looking on Twitter. I get an advert for the app called Calm, and it was awarded apparently App of the Year by Apple. And what Calm does is that when you click on it, it gives you a picture of rain raining or trees waving as if you're looking out the window. And I just want to say, do you know what? Do you know what's a lot better than that? Just look out the window. And actually, the idea that artificial intelligence can substitute for real life experience, I think for me is a significant boundary. And actually, when we hold on to that boundary, many of these other arguments actually fall away. So when I phone up a helpline at the bank, I do not want to speak to an artificial voice, give me lots of alternatives. I will press the buttons as many times as I can until I get to speak to a person. And actually, human communication is something that is both much more complex than often artificial intelligence systems realize. And I find it fascinating that AI can do all sorts of amazing things when it can produce, you know, videos of what appears real life people. And yet still on my iPhone, it can't predict my text. So we need to recognize that human interaction, human communication is actually at a computational level, irreducible. And it's when we cross that boundary into thinking that the phenomena replicated is actually replicating human experience, which it isn't.
Well, interestingly, when I obviously hang out with the AI community very, very much, and what you find is that generally they are the least gadget-oriented, least social media aware bunch of people you'd ever come across. Most are walkers, runners, hikers, or gardeners.
Some don't even allow smartphones into their homes.
And some don't even allow their own technologies into the hands of their kids. And, I accept everything that Dr. Paul has said. He's absolutely right. But as I said, AI is about trying to solve hard problems. It's not trying to, pull people into a new reality or whatever. It's solving, some very demanding tasks. And I suppose the objective is not to replace human beings at all.
I think, Barry, in that vein, we've focused on a discussion about artificial intelligence, but if we look back to, say, the work of Licklider in 1960, he wrote a wonderful paper, Man-Computer Symbiosis, which predated computers as we know them now, predated the internet, and he spoke about the symbiotic relationship between man and machine. And I think that if we are to get the best out of machine learning systems, the best from artificial intelligence, then really we should be talking about IA, intelligence augmentation. And what that does, it places the human at the center of the transaction and uses machine intelligence to actually augment human performance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mary, will we need a religion or faith in a world where AI is predominant?
I think we will need faith even more in a world where technology becomes, dominant, because it is the essence of what it is to be human at all sorts of levels. And I think it is also the essence of how people connect with each other. And when you look at when things go wrong online in terms of all sorts of terrible behaviors, and certainly in my role at Europol, we see everything from, sextortion through to cyber fraud to cyber crime. The point at which we want good things to flourish online, certainly religion can have a role there. So if you look at altruism and crowdsourced fundraising, and if you also think about religion in an abstract context, say the manifestation of a miracle, what better place for religion to truly manifest for people of all different faiths than in cyberspace?
You mentioned at the beginning, at the top of the program, that of the 50th anniversary of Daisy, of the 2001 A Space Odyssey. 2018 is also the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein. and I suppose one of the things that sort of stands out in Frankenstein for me is the fact that when the creature meets Victor Frankenstein again, he argues that as a living being, one of his fundamental rights is to be happy, and so he demands a mate. And so it's interesting that to the extent that Frankenstein itself is the creature of Frankenstein is an AI, the thing that it seeks in life is actually happiness and love. And I think that's kind of comforting.
Well, the question is, in a world of AI, do we need religion? Well, we certainly do, in terms of how we put boundaries around it. I mean, I think Barry was quite right in saying that nobody invents or develops AI with the intention of replacing human beings. But of course, the reality is that we are lazy and we are flawed and we are corrupt. Michael McIntyre's got a wonderfully amusing sketch about parenting, where he and using technology, where he says, the kids come in early in the morning, here's the iPad, check the battery, and he frisbees the iPad over the kids so he can go to sleep for another 2 hours. And of course, that's not the intention by which people made iPads, but nevertheless, we are lazy and we seek power. I think it'd be a very interesting question to ask whether those who invented Facebook really were doing it with the altruistic aim of connecting humanity with each other. I'm sorry, I don't think that was the principal object.
And
technology is always vulnerable.
It was a dating platform. That's how.
It comes back to those fundamentals.
Money, sex, and power.
Yeah.
But I suppose, on the question of religion, I'm not at all a religious person. I was raised a Catholic. My mother was amused that I was coming on the show. She said, "What do you know about religion?" but I suppose for me, as a non-religious person, and I absolutely respect people's faith and so on, for me, focusing on the ethical issues, and I'm happy for those to be informed by whatever background and whatever moral or ethical compass one has, I think that this is really where we need to be, because there needs to be sort of an international consensus as to how we would like technology to develop. And so particularly in the context of its relationship with human beings, which is why I very much like this idea that AI should treat a human being as the ends and not the means.
Well, Ian, we can go back as far as Genesis to maybe let's bring this conversation to a close, which was that the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Will the same happen when AI happens?
It is. And what's fascinating, I think you're quoting there from Genesis 8, and you're talking about the tower. You're talking about the flood narrative, but then you go on in chapter Genesis 11 to Babel. And what you're seeing there is an archetypal description of technology and the way that technology allows people to concentrate power in themselves and the evil ends to which that can be used. And I think, again, a Christian theological perspective would say we always need to ask questions about technology, which leads to the aggregation and the concentration of power and how that power is used. And those are ancient ethical questions which aren't going away.
And Mary Aiken, as a cyberpsychologist, have we more to fear from the human than from the AI?
Well, that's a very good question, because it really points to a fundamental question in terms of if we think about technology and the connectivity afforded to us by the internet and facilitated by machine learning, effectively, when we have this incredible connectivity that as humans we can connect in a way that we've never connected before, and then when we see everything that goes wrong in terms of negative behaviors online, the real question in terms of causation is, does technology cause bad behavior? Or, as Jung said, does it, you know, really shine a very bright light into what Jung described as the million-year-old man, the darkest reaches of the human psyche? And are we all just, you know, Game of Thrones underneath it all?
Well, there we must leave the topic. It's an interesting one for all of us that with self-driving and cars and buses coming down the road, you'd hope that it will make the correct moral decision should we happen to step out in front of it. That's the Leap of Faith for this evening. My thanks to the Reverend Dr. Ian Paul in Nottingham, Professor Barry O'Sullivan in Cork, and in Copenhagen, Dr. Mary Aiken. You can ask your AI assistant to play us back on your podcast anytime, and indeed you can email us with your comments at faith@rte.ie. Next week on the programme, I take a trip to the Pro Cathedral in Dublin to meet Gerard Gillan. This coming Sunday, September 30th, is the day the titular organist Gerard Gillan retires after 42 years of service. Archbishop Martin will celebrate the 11 o'clock Mass, and Gerard will play as titular organist for the last time. He's our guest next week. From all of us here on the programme, good night.